This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Journalism is a dangerous profession under a military dictatorship. My guest, Dapo Olorunyomi, edited several opposition publications in Nigeria. When the military told him to apologize for stories, he refused. When they closed down his publication, he published it from underground. Last June, he went into hiding after he learned that the dictatorship had targeted him as one of 40 alleged coup plotters. Last New Year's Eve, his publication's offices were firebombed. Soon after, he snuck out of the country. With the help of Amnesty International USA and the Committee to Protect Journalists, he came to the United States. In March, he received the Editor of the Year Award from the World Press Review for his enterprise, courage, and leadership in advancing freedom and responsibility of the press. 3 years ago today, Nigeria held its first democratic election in a decade. And then the military regime annulled the results. The regime hadn't counted on Nigerians voting for the transition to civil rule.
At the last minute, it was very clear to the military that Nigerians had voted en masse for his democratic dispensation. And I think because they were also not prepared to leave, they just had to annul that election. So what we're having today is an anniversary of that occasion, forced to other campaign to the international community that it's a serious problem of a dictatorship killing its people and that country in Nigeria. And secondly, to say that the man who actually won a presidential election had been put in jail by the people who stole his mandate.
And Abiola, who was presumed to have won the election, is still in jail.
Yes, he is still in jail, and in a very, as we understand from medical reports, in a very terrible medical state.
Last week, the wife of Abiola, who was the presumed winner of the election that was annulled, was murdered. She was murdered by six gunmen. What is your theory of what happened? What do you believe happened?
I think basically it's possible to interpret it from two points of view. The point of view of the government, which suggests that she was murdered by hoodlums, and what the Nigerian people generally believe, that this was the work of the government. And it fits into a pattern because there's a politics of assassination in Nigeria in the past 6 months or so. One of the greatest nationalists, Chief Rewani, was murdered early this year. He's a very critical man of about 70, very critical of the government. Then, of course, you know what happened to, perhaps you know what happened to the writer and environmentalist last November. He was actually murdered too. And there had been cases of this kind of selective targeting of opposition element in the country. So we believe very strongly that what has happened to Mrs. Abiola is the handwork of the government.
Now, before the election, you published an article in Nigeria that was critical of the National Electoral Commission. The government was very angry with your article. What did they do?
Well, they just picked me up and with some of my colleagues who collaborated on the report, we just found ourselves in court and the judge was not willing to even accept our right to defense. And before we knew it, we were in jail and we were there for 14 days. It was one of the most harrowing moments anybody could have. And it was carefully done because if you go into the Nigerian jail, you're supposed to be in for a day in a waiting room before you are shared into the regular cells. But they took us there on Friday, which meant that Friday, Saturday, Sunday, nobody was to receive us. And we were about 64 in that very tiny room. And they brought in enough criminals to really help them do the dirty work. You know, thoroughly assaulted us. It was such a filthy place. They brought in some armed robbers that had gunshots with the police, so fresh blood. The toilet facility was right there in. So once you choose an elbow space, you dare not just move in that cell because you really get beaten by the criminals.
What are some of the other articles that you published that angered the military government and that the military government took action against?
Well, they've actually taken action against virtually everything that we have done. I think the problem I had its genesis in 1992, April. I was working for a newspaper Chief Abiola's newspaper then. I was a political editor of a magazine called The African Concord. And we drew attention to the transition of the then dictator, General Ibrahim Babangida. And I had speculated that this transition was not going to lead this country anywhere. And there was a hidden agenda that Nigerians needed to know. So they shut the paper down because of that. And they wanted us to apologize before they would reopen the paper. And I said, no, I wasn't going to do that. So I resigned. And because this was happening for the first time in the history of Nigeria, it drew a lot of, you know, publicity.
This was the first time that the government tried to shut down a paper?
No, not the first time, but they were encountering journalists who would just say no for the first time.
Oh, it was the first time that the journalists were standing up to the government.
Ordinarily, you know, people will make a deal. Perhaps they will write such letters. And so because of this, it drew a lot of attention, which fired the imagination of most Nigerians. And this kind of publicity, I think the government was not happy about. They couldn't do anything about it. I mean, and four of my colleagues also walked out of the paper, including the editor. So we later came together to set up our own newspaper, got some sponsors from young financiers, and immediately we started, you know, started running into trouble. February 8, 1993, we actually started. 4 weeks into it was the incidents we just spoke about when we were taken to jail. By May, they had closed down the paper, and we had to resort again to some kind of underground publishing.
So after the government raided the office and virtually took over the publication, how did you publish from underground? Where did you set up? How did you get money and materials?
Well, the first thing we did was to, because we were publishing the fairly glossy kind of magazine, which was a little more expensive, more difficult to publish. So we reverted to publishing, you know, on newsprint, tabloid size, but certainly not tabloid content, which was easier to handle. And you could do your desktop operation virtually anywhere in Lagos. But it also inspired us a little bit. Because one, you needed a newsroom to discuss story ideas, and we had to use facilities like stadium, theater, and so on. We split the staff. We asked the business desk, for instance, just to go buy tickets and go to the stadium. So just like regular stadium spectators, they would just discuss their story ideas there. The political department would probably be discussing at the theater. So you could, I mean, the police would certainly not be able to dictate anything. And at the end of the day, they knew a pool where they would drop the stories. And it was difficult, of course, but it was worth doing.
Today is the third anniversary of the day that the Nigerian elections were annulled. What did you publish on the day the election was annulled?
Well, I mean, that's interesting. We had published, how did we cast the headline? Babangida was there then, and I think we said...
Babangida was the military dictator at that time.
I think we kind of said, you know, he has his signature, IBB. That's what they call him. And we said, I think IBB has done it again, you know, aborts Nigeria's history or something like that.
Aborts Nigeria's history?
And but at that time, the whole country had gone into some kind of confusion, so... they really couldn't, and our paper was just selling like hotcake, you know. So, and was helping to give a direction to the people about what was happening, about what to do, and all that.
So, what was the military dictator's response to your paper that day?
Well, they immediately we went on the ground. They had difficulty understanding what was going on. Initially, they said we were publishing from neighboring country, and I think they just tried to search all the border. They asked the borders to be tightened. And
so you were already underground at
this time? Yes, but we were certainly within Nigeria. At other times, you know, we had the rumor that they were really searching the seaports because these things were being brought in. I think when they made no progress about it, they actually went on national network to see when the Minister for Information then said we were actually publishing this thing within the American embassy. That's the most outrageous thing to say. But the truth about it is that we were really publishing this newspaper just behind the police headquarters, and they never knew it.
In Lagos?
Right, yeah, in Lagos.
Now, how did you manage to publish just across from police headquarters in the middle of Nigeria?
Well, Lagos, if you know, is also like sweet chaos, a nation with its metropolitan area about 4 million people. And it's difficult to effectively police Lagos. And given the new technologies in publishing, it's generally easy to do this. Because we had broken down the traditional structures of publishing. And I think the security were still frozen in their own conception of publishing. They expected a newspaper house where everything was working. But now we had a newsroom which was new, if you like, so realistic. You had distribution channel which was totally new. Well, and once you can make your artwork, you could actually take this to different cities, just duplicate them, and so you could print, you know, any of the local presses.
Your wife and infant child were arrested. When was that, and what were they arrested for?
That was on one occasion in 1993. I think that was May, prior to the proscription of our magazine. It's difficult to know which particular story now because they kept coming. But when they came to the office, they couldn't reach me. So they went to the house and they met my wife walking on the table. We just had this a second baby then. And they said, well, where's your husband? And she said, well, he should be at work by now. And said, no, we've been to work and he's not there. I said, well, I mean, he's a journalist. He's probably hunting for a story or something. And said no. So he said, well, just go around. And they went into the room, you know, they broke into everything. They took away all our wedding pictures, everything, the album, and the ones that had not been put in jackets. And then they stumbled into the reading room and said, what? I mean, this is a funny part of it, that does this man even give you upkeep money with all his books? Looks like he's been spending all his money to buy books. And at the end of the day, you know, you think it was a joke and say, well, you have to come with us. And they took mother and child to the police station. And but because, you know, the evening papers quickly picked on that, our neighbors alerted the lawyers, and the lawyer quickly alerted the papers. I think it was too much of an embarrassment for them. And I understand some of the diplomats actually called the police to say, look, what's going on? You people are really getting... Why do you pick an infant, you know? But they do this, and it's fair enough to say all this here, but I'm not a typical situation in any way. There's a friend of mine who had a problem like this. He had a 7 months... His wife was pregnant, 7 months, and he had done a story, and he suspected this would lead to some problems, so he left Lagos, and they came for his wife, and they held her for 5 days, you know. So these guys are really, really crazy, and they will do anything.
How long did they hold your wife and
child? Oh, just for about 18 hours or so.
My guest is Dapo Olorunyomi. He edited several of Nigeria's leading opposition publications. And last year, he was named Editor of the Year by World Press Review. In 1995, he was named by his government as one of 40 coup plotters. After that happened, he went into hiding. Last January, he escaped to the United States. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Dapo Olorunyomi. He's a Nigerian journalist now living in exile in the United States. He was named as one of the 40 coup plotters, and after that, he fled the country. How did you find out that you were one of the people named?
Well, they came to the office. This was a very interesting story because in March last year, the government announced that it uncovered a mutiny in the army.
A mutiny in the army?
Yeah, and they arrested 40 officers. And we thought this was curious because the profile of the officers suggested that, no, these were very bright guys. And most of them PhDs, MS degrees. And secondly, and that's the most important point, they were not holding any operational position in the army. Most of them were either legal services, public relations, medical corps, and all that. And we got the information that these guys were just the critical section in the army, and the dictatorship just wanted to waste them. So we pursued the story, and luckily we got some if you like, confidential military information, which suggested that, in fact, within the military itself, there's a debate that this was a mistake to have gone to the public and announced a coup when there was nothing. So we published this. And if you know the ego of dictators, you've really gone beyond the boundary. So they wanted to arrest me. They kept coming to the office, and my colleagues said, well, you better don't go, you know. Of course, after we broke the story, some other independent newspapers also followed and, you know, tried to really mess up the government. And at the end of the day, four of our colleagues were arrested and first sentenced to life. It was clear to everybody that they just wanted to make an example of how you have to operate, you know. I mean, we didn't think this was anything, seriously. But the most painful for me, particularly, is my colleague who was just coming to the office that day, and he was just coming from the hospital after 3 months of kidney. He was treating kidney, and till date, we've not seen him. He was one of those who was convicted, you know, for this so-called coup, this phantom coup.
So your friend who had been in the hospital getting kidney treatment is now...
He's now in jail.
...serving a life sentence?
Well, because of international and national pressure, the government later said it was commuting the time to 15 years. So they're all serving 15 years, including a woman editor.
So you stayed in Nigeria in hiding for about a half a year?
Yeah, that's right.
How did you hide?
Well, as I said earlier, it's risky, true, but you just have to take some of this risk. You just keep moving. I had to sleep, you know, at different places every night. It's not comfortable. It's really, really, well, it disrupts your total family life. I didn't have to see my kids and my wife.
Early this year,
yeah.
You actually got out of Nigeria.
Yeah.
How did you get out, can you say?
Yeah, well, through the illegal borders, you know, just pick your passport and just...
Well, you couldn't use your passport with your name on it, could you?
Yes, the passport, since I didn't need to show it to anybody. Yeah. I just had it, you know, and it was actually buried somewhere in my pants.
You don't need to show the passport
no,
when you're leaving the country?
Because I didn't go through the official border. Yeah.
So you snuck out?
Yeah, that's right.
And what place did you choose to sneak out?
Well, true. You know, Nigeria has about 700 land borders, so you could just get across most places. You still probably meet some patrol guards.
Did you meet any patrol guards?
Yeah, but they didn't know who they were talking to because I was in a group, and these were groups they had known always. These are smugglers who deal in second-hand clothing. So they thought we were going to buy some things to come back in the evening. And that's the joke. I said that one of the guards actually requested that I should bring a bottle of brandy when coming back in the evening.
And of course you didn't do that.
I'll do that one day.
My guest is Dapo Olorunyomi. He's a Nigerian journalist who fled Nigeria in early 1996. This was after he was named as one of the 40 coup plotters. What are some of your thoughts about the press in America?
Well, that's interesting. You know, I think the American press is so crucial for the definition of freedom and democracy in this country. But sometimes it's surprisingly very ignorant about world processes. Somehow, too, it's always looking for a local connection before it takes up a course in other parts of the world. Sometimes... Funny enough, those local connections are very clear, but they can't see it, and I can't understand that aspect of it. It's an ignorance that really baffles me. When I was in Arizona, a newspaper man wanted to talk to me, and he said, well, yeah, but you must forgive me. I can't see any local connection between the United States and Nigeria. And I said, well, that's unfortunate because... One, Nigeria, the United States has about $2.7 billion investment in the oil sector alone in Nigeria. And if you consider that what the United States total investment in South Africa is just $4.2 billion, you see what we're talking about. And Well, there's a general spiritual angle too, that Nigeria is home to the largest black population, 100 million people, which is a fifth of the 550 million African people. And given the African-American population, I thought that was also some kind of connection. And, well, in a very general sense, you know, there's a connection about humanity. But if all this does not catch, it's also important that Americans should know that United States buys 90% of Nigeria's oil, which is very low in lead, you know, and so easy to refine. And these are very important connections. Or the fact that, look, the heroin that ends up in the United States, most of the heroin drugs, they are not manufactured in Nigeria, but they are rooted through Nigeria from Burma. Although the paradox in that is that both in Burma and in Nigeria, you have a very, very vicious dictatorships that are supported by American corporations. What Shell is doing in Nigeria is also what Pepsi Cola is doing in Burma. And both countries, surprisingly, Burma and Nigeria, we don't have local drug problems. So it's important to know that these drugs destroying American youths are coming through a source supported by big corporations, in American big corporations, and a dictatorship that is not doing anything. These are enough reasons for Americans to show a lot of interest.
Dapo Olorunyomi is a Nigerian journalist in exile. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Dapo Olorunyomi. He edited several opposition publications in Nigeria. Last year, he went into hiding after he was targeted by the military regime as one of 40 alleged coup plotters. He escaped to the U.S. early this year. When we left off, he was explaining why what happens in Nigeria is relevant to America. What most connects our countries is oil. What's the larger picture of the oil relationship between America and Nigeria?
Well, one is that most of the oil producing companies in Nigeria have American parenthood, like Chevron, like Mobil, and of course Shell. Well, Shell USA always tries to make the case that we are not in Nigeria in a technical sense. That is the European parents that are in Nigeria. But anyway, Shell USA buys Nigeria's oil, so they're still in Nigeria in that sense. Then secondly, most of the oil service companies, like those helping to lay pipes and all that, the American companies like Wilbros. Wilbros is an Oklahoma firm, and it's in very big business in Nigeria. That's as far as working there is concerned.
Now, is the current military regime considered to be sympathetic to American oil interests in Nigeria?
Well, it would seem so, because the oil companies managed to get very good deals. And I think they also prefer a dictatorship in that country because they're doing very good business. Last year, Shell made about 180 million pounds. I don't know how much that converts in dollars, profit. That's not the big problem. The point about that is that only 10% of this goes as cost. I don't think Shell can get that anywhere in the world. And how does this come about? Terrible environmental records. They are just messing the whole place through oil spills and gas flare. And this they cannot do in any other part of the world. And then I think they generally have good wage policies. That under a democracy, you know, the government will try to bring them to account for a little more than they are doing. Then, of course, their service companies, they're just devastating the land. Something that is not well known is that the oil-producing area of Nigeria is just a little portion of what remains of the tropical rainforest in Africa. And this is also home to a lot of herbs. Indeed, I think the American Cancer Society is doing some research in those areas, hoping that, you know, whatever will come out of cancer research, this forest can contribute something. And it's also home to many rare species like the white-throated monkey. But all these are just being bulldozed, and a dictatorship that has no conception of civilized ethics. Just what they want is just money, you know, bribery. So they don't care. I mean, they really support the outrageous policies of these big companies.
What would you like to see the United States do?
Well, we're calling for some kind of sanctions. Sanctions, for instance, to freeze the assets of these military generals. They've stolen a lot of this wealth, which are invested outside Nigeria. We understand some of these, especially in property terms, are in the United States, but of course mainly in Europe. And in the new frenzy that they are also getting into, they've been moving a lot to Asia. But I think the United States can take a leadership to help put a pressure on this. But most importantly, we're also calling for an oil embargo, because oil is the only platform that sustains the dictatorship, and that oil never really gets to the people. Although we pump 2.4 million barrels of oil a day, the shame is that we still import oil from Venezuela.
How have you been feeling since coming to the United States? Are you lonely?
I am indeed very lonely. I think I must confess about that. But lonely only to the extent that when I think of, you know, my colleagues back home, the problems they're having, I guess I'm also being moralistic about it, especially for this guy who has kidney. I mean, it could have been me, and he's not, you know, he just refused to give up. He needn't be there, you know. I just keep thinking of these problems sometimes. Guess it's just human to do, but I also understand that I have to convert my time to do useful work for the country.
You have a colleague who's in prison now, in part because he refused to say anything about you.
That's right.
Do you ask yourself, if you were taken into prison and you were threatened with a long term in prison, if you didn't give up somebody else, do you think you'd be able to hold firm?
I think he was doing that because he knew, too, that that was what I would have done. I mean, and that was not my first experience. I had a particularly rough year in 1994. This was amazing. And there's something of interest about this. The man who, the colonel who was leading, you know, the theme then, they were questioning me, and they actually brutalized me because I wouldn't yield my sources. He was part of the coup that we had to campaign for, and the coup plot, the so-called coup plotters. And you can see how ironic the whole thing played out. And I remember then how he was saying that I was so rude, I was just arrogant, I was dealing with military matters as if I'm, you know. And he asked the soldiers to really beat me up. They crushed my left hand, and it was in cast. It's a still very weak hand. It was in cast for 3 months. But as fortune will turn around, in 1995, you know, he had fallen out of favor with the government, and he was part of the so-called coup plotters, and we now had to campaign to save his own life. So what I think Kunle knows...
that's bizarre.
Yeah.
Well, did you participate in the campaign to save his life?
Yeah, that's what we're doing. That's what led me to this exile. That's the basis of my present problem, just to save these guys. And some of them had actually done outrageous things against Nigerians. But there's a point, we have to just put a stop to this cycle of madness.
Do you hope someday to be able to meet this guy?
It will be very interesting. It will be very interesting. I really look forward to meeting him. Although, something happened. I got a strange letter once, you know, in Nigeria. Apparently from his wife or one of his relatives. Just hinted at that. Like saying we're sorry about this. So he might have mentioned that to them.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Dapo Olorunyomi is a Nigerian journalist living in exile in America. This is Fresh Air.